Brooke, do you think we should tell the listeners what tomorrow is right at the beginning of the episode?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great idea. It's a very important day. Why don't you tell them?
Tomorrow, October the 2nd, is Wrongful Conviction Day.
I know when I first heard about Wrongful Conviction Day, it sounded kind of like a holiday, which made me wonder why people would celebrate wrongful convictions. But it's not really like that at all.
It's more like a day of advocacy. Wrongful Conviction Day is an international day to raise awareness of the cause and remedies of wrongful convictions and to recognize the tremendous personal, social, and emotional cost of wrongful conviction for innocent people and their families.
The California Innocence Project is doing a Twitter takeover to bring even more awareness to the cause. If you have a Twitter, at least for tomorrow, you should definitely follow them at @CA_innocence.
We also have a thank you shout out to give in relationship to Wrongful Conviction Day.
Yeah, this is such a touching story. A longtime listener and supporter of Actual Innocence, Melly, sent me a message on Twitter asking if there was anything we needed because she wanted to help support us in honor of Wrongful Conviction Day. I came up with some ideas, but I wanted to run them by her and DeMarco together. So I asked both of them if they were okay with doing a quick Skype together, and they said yes.
Yeah, she was really nice, and she's donating a printer to the Actual Innocence team, which will help out a lot. So thank you so much, Melly, for your kind gift, and it was really a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Okay, now on to this week's episode of Actual Innocence.
I'm Jeffrey Duskovic, and I'm with the Jeffrey Duskovic Foundation for Justice.
Hi, this is Brooke. I'm here with DeMarco, and you're listening to Actual Innocence. We're a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful conviction and issues in the justice system. How have you been this week, DeMarco?
Well, I had an interesting week. I spent my week relaxing and doing a lot of just thinking. And when I say thinking, just like, I remember when I was in prison and I said, when I get out, I want to do this or I want to do that. And now I'm out here doing all these things that I want to do. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with who Be Legit is, but Be Legit is a rapper from Vallejo, California. Him, E40, The Click, you know, they're a family-oriented rap group. But I grew up listening to him, but I got to meet him. And that was that for me, that was pretty cool. You know, I'm meeting people that I grew up listening to, and I'm speaking with people and just, you know, and that's why I say I've just been, you know, just in thought about my week. Like, I'm proud of where I am, you know, the things that I have accomplished.
Is it overwhelming when you think about where you were and where you are now? How does it feel to see how far you've come?
It makes me feel good. It can be overwhelming at times, but, you know, it makes me feel good. It feels good about myself. You know, I pat myself on the back, you know, like I've accomplished this, you know. You know, it's hard and it's a struggle, but still, you know, focused, and I'm welcoming each challenge, and it's good. It's a good experience.
And you, again, were the person this week who scheduled our interview. It's Jeff Duskovic, and he actually told his story on Actual Innocence a long time ago, but he's come such a long way too, and I'm glad that you invited him back to the show and he was able to give us some updates.
Yes, I met Jeff in San Diego this past conference at the Innocence Conference, and I met Jeff and we got to hang out and we became friends. We exchanged contact information. And, you know, as I'm following him on Facebook, you know, he's posting all these great things. You know, he's helping people. His organization is doing well. His foundation is doing well. So, you know, I'm following him. So one day, you know, I reached out to him, and me and him, I called him and we talked, and he gave me a lot of good points. He gave me some good information. And we talked for about 30, 40 minutes, and I just listened to him and asked some questions, and he could relate to me, and I didn't feel dumb or, you know, asking him questions, because we both was in the same place, basically. So, you know, for me to ask this question, I felt like I could relate. I knew he knew what I was going through, and, you know, he didn't have any problems answering the questions that I asked him.
So this week, we've kind of switched it around. This week, you have the trivia questions.
Yes, I do.
Before we go on to that, though, I was hoping that we could talk about our first sponsor.
Sure. Today sponsors are SeatGeek, Crane and Canopy, and Kopari. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. I actually just use SeatGeek to buy tickets to a Thunder game, baby! SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Brooke?
Thank you. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code ACTUAL today. That's promo code ACTUAL for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
What year did Jeff get his high school diploma?
Oh, that's rough. I know that Jeff recently went to his high school reunion, but I can't remember what class he was.
It's a bit of a trick question right here.
Yeah?
Yes, what year did Jeff get his high school diploma?
I don't know.
He'll get it in 2018, provided his school is cooperative.
Oh, yeah, because he got his GED, but he still wanted to get that diploma. You're right. You're absolutely right.
But, yeah, I'm glad to introduce Jeff. Yeah. Personal friend of mine, Jeff Deskovic.
This isn't our typical interview because we have talked to you before and we've heard your story before, but you took the money you got, like compensating you for being wrongly convicted, and you're not just using it to help yourself, but you're using it to help a lot of other people who've been in that situation. I just think that's amazing.
Thank you. My sense of moral responsibility, and my of trying to help people that I metaphorically left behind, it feels very strongly, and I feel like this is the reason why I'm in the world, is to do this type of work, fighting wrongful convictions, and, that has different forms. I mean, to me, the highest aspect of that is actually trying to free people, but there are wild other aspects, such as raising awareness and the policy work, that's important as well. So I try to do something of everything.
I really commend you. I know what we have to go through all that. And for you to get out here and still be, continuing with your education and all that you've been doing, I just want to commend you on that.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So could you just give us a general overview of the foundation for anyone who might not have heard the episode before that you were in?
Sure. The foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to free people who've been wrongfully imprisoned, as well as to prevent the injustices from happening in the first place by seeking policy changes. Part of the way that we try to bring about policy changes is raising awareness.
So I did a little research on some of your foundation work and some of your foundation's work, and I was hoping, is it okay if we ask about that?
Of course. Yes, it is. Of course it is.
I've seen the name Lorenzo Johnson associated with your foundation, and it seems like his moment was coming, but then he was kind of bullied by the prosecution, and I was hoping that maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that case.
Sure, of course. Yes, yeah, that's a great way to summarize it. So, Lorenzo Johnson was wrongfully convicted in Pennsylvania. It had a unique twist to it because he was a New York resident who was wrongfully convicted in a state other than his own. So he was wrongfully convicted in Pennsylvania, where it's alleged that Lorenzo and a co-defendant, Corey Walker, who remains wrongfully imprisoned right now. There has a evidentiary hearing coming up later on in this September. That they were in a bar, and that they left the bar with the victim, and that Lorenzo was like in the middle, and that the victim was in the middle, and that Lorenzo was behind the victim, and the shooter was in front of him, and that they walked in like a block and a half from the bar into an alley, and that Lorenzo was standing on the sidewalk, both serving as a type of lookout as well as preventing the victim from running. And there was a woman who was walking by on the sidewalk who claimed to have saw this. She said she walked past Lorenzo, and then she heard a gunshot, and then she started running, and that was all she said that she saw. And they claimed that, you know, that the victim was murdered in revenge for beating up the co-defendant, that there was drug money that the victim owed, and that led to an altercation in which the victim beat up Lorenzo's co-defendant, Corey Walker, with a whisk broom in the parking lot of a Kentucky Fried Chicken. All right, so that's the... Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, I can't imagine being in a fight and using a wisp broom as a weapon. I mean, that's kind of bizarre on its face, right?
What is a wisp broom?
A wisp broom. All right, it's a broom made of straw.
Okay, that's what I was just wanted to clarify that. That's what.
Wow. Yeah, not, that sounds like something my mom would use.
Yeah, not exactly the best weapon. Not an interesting weapon of choice, right?
Very interesting.
So after 16 and a half years, Lorenzo was released by the federal court on grounds that there was legally insufficient evidence. You know, so my foundation wasn't involved with Lorenzo at that point. We had just started corresponding towards the tail end of that, maybe the last 3-4 months. Lorenzo was a writer. He used to write about wrongful conviction issues, and he used to, like a lot of exonerees, he used to read a lot of material about wrongful conviction. And so that led him to become aware of me, because before I had the foundation, I was an individual advocate. And, you know, and in that capacity, you know, I was a columnist for 5 years. So I wrote articles as well as speaking, doing media interviews. So that's how I came to be on his radar. And so we started writing while his case was still in court. And so when the court ruled for him that way, he wrote me right away and said, "Hey, this is what just happened. I'm on my way home." I made copies of like all the articles I had in print at that point. It was close to like 200. I made copies and I sent it out to him so that he could then distribute it in the prison system, go to the law library, make copies and pass it around, because a lot of prisoners say that when they read the articles that I write on wrongful convictions, that it's inspirational to them, to motivate them to keep going. So long story short, he was released, and then my foundation assisted Lorenzo in reintegrating into society. I mean, we gave him some emergency funding. We remained in regular contact with him, he himself wound up with a job, and he got his driver's license. He met a fiance, and he was putting his life together. Life was good. The only problem, though, was that there was one more appeal left, which was the U.S. Supreme Court. So the Pennsylvania Attorney General had appealed the reversal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And not only did they grant them permission to appeal to them, but they also reinstated his conviction all at once. Lorenzo wanted to stay and fight and try to clear his name as opposed to going on the run. So that resulted in my having to do the most difficult thing that I've barely ever had to do in my life, other than things associated with my own wrongful conviction. He asked me to drive him back to prison, because if I didn't, he would have to take a bus from New York back to Pennsylvania, you know, by himself. That was an emotional load right there to do that. So because he had that rapport, my foundation agreed to assist him in his effort to get exonerated. I mean, there was a small portion of his case. Like, some of the people were in New York. Most of them, the bulk of them, were in Pennsylvania, but there was a couple of things to do in New York. So we agreed to do a little bit of investigative work on in the New York side, but mainly contribute on the public relational side of things, whereas he had other legal entities that were helping him with the legal investigative work. It was attorney Michael Wiseman. There was a federal capital habeas unit. Later on, the Pennsylvania Innocence Project got involved. And then, you know, the foundation brought other entities to the table. So we persuaded Lonnie Sori from Sori Communications to assist us on the public relational level. I mean, Lonnie's been instrumental in getting media attention from Marty Tinkliff, West Memphis 3, Derek Hamilton, et cetera. And then Thomas Dichter from Decarcerate Pennsylvania also got involved to help Lorenzo with his website, doing email blasts. And we connected him to Huffington Post. So Lorenzo started writing again, and he was publishing it there. And we were promoting on social media. Dichter was helping him edit it and publish it there. So he had like a whole team around him. Everybody, we were fighting his case like on every conceivable level. I mean, the foundation was renting buses, and we used to bus his family and other supporters in New York, from New York to PA. We would do rallies, protests, and press conferences. We used to go outside the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office, and we got him a lot of coverage and kept his case alive in the media while the other entities were fighting the cases on a different other levels. We initially thought, kind of naively, in retrospect, we thought that, you know, maybe he might be inside like a year, you know, because we had definite ideas as to, you know, what directions to go in investigative-wise. But, you know, we started hitting walls. And at the same time, you know, there were other appeals that were filed unrelated to the investigation. So he started losing some of the appeals, and we kept hitting walls. But it finally turned around, and there was a lot of evidence that was uncovered that was unknown before. And the evidence that was uncovered is what led the court to order an evidentiary hearing on Brady violations. So long story short, what was uncovered was that sole witness that I told you about earlier, the woman who claimed that she walked by and she heard the gunshot. So it come to find out she had been an alternative suspect in the case, and that had never been disclosed.
Oh, my gosh.
Whoa.
And the motive witness who came up with the Kentucky Fried Chicken wrist broom fighting incident, she had a...
That's so absurd.
It is. What we learned is almost even more absurd than her story. She had like a quasi familial relationship with the lead detective's mother.
Oh, yeah.
And there were hundreds of pages that had been, you know, withheld from him as well. So that was the basis of the evidentiary hearing was going to be about. We rented a couple of vans and to pack the courtroom, and, you know, it was on. As far as we were concerned, you know, this was it. This is the moment we waited. And the court really dragged its feet to even just schedule the hearing. They made him wait like a year and a half. After everything had been discovered and the briefs were filed, imagine waiting a year and a half after that, all that information came out just to get to the hearing. So the night before the hearing, that this is when the bullying comes into play, is that the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office, they contacted Lorenzo's lawyers, and they said, look, you know, the judge may take 3 to 6 months to make a ruling. If we lose, we're gonna appeal the decision a couple of times, and, you know, all told, this could take a couple of years here, you know, it could take 2-3 years, possibly. And considering that it took a year and a half for the court to schedule the hearing, I mean, that wasn't like no empty threat. And by that point, Lorenzo had like 5 years in since he came back, since he had he had returned back in, 22 years overall. So we can go that route. We can keep going, or you can end all this and you can go home tomorrow. But go home tomorrow, the price for that, though, is you have to plead nolo contendere to a third-degree murder charge. So that's like a legal, that's like a specialized legal plea in which the defendant is saying, telling the court, look, I'm innocent, but I recognize that there's a possibility that I might lose. And, you know, I don't want to be exposed to the greater penalty if I lose. So I'm just going to, I'm not going to fight the case anymore. I'm going to just take the plea. I'm not going to contest this. And so that's the plea that he entered. And I didn't want him to do it. I actually told him not to do it, but you know, his other entities with him, you know, suggested that he did do it. And I understood his reasoning. You know, he's like, look, it's been 22 years. You know, how long am I going to keep going? How long am I going to keep going with this? You know, my mother is 81 years old. You know, I don't want to pass while I'm in here. You know, and plus, I'm worried, you know, there's the rest of my family to think about. And then in addition to that, I mean, you know, I don't trust the system anymore. You know, they wrongfully convicted me once. It took me 16 and a half years to straighten it out. And that only held up for 4 months. And then I've been back here for 5 years since then. I mean, there, you know, sure, 98% I'm going to win on this, but there's a slight chance I might not win. I mean, this is life without parole here. You know, and what if I lose one of the other appeals? So took the agreement. But I consider it all to be abusive because they didn't offer him that because they wanted to. They offered him that deal because they realized that they were going to lose, right? Other than that, they were perfectly content for him to continue on with a life without parole sentence. You know? And if they realized they were going to lose, then, you know, you have no business threatening to drag it on for years and years and years just so that you can try to preserve a conviction force of a plea out of somebody just so that at the end, see? He was guilty. We told you all along. Mm-hmm. That's so abusive, you know, and that just ties into, you know, the awareness, you know, in the last year on the problem of innocent people, you know, being forced to plead guilty, you know, whether that's the nolo contendere pleas, the Alford plea, or just straight pleading guilty.
The Alford plea, how is that different from the nolo contendere?
It's not. It's the same plea, just a different name. Yeah. So, I mean, in recognition of that problem, Innocence Project, you know, has the, you know, their guilty plea problem, a website and, you know, pushing to raise attention to that. And, you know, there's been, I think it was Judge Rakoff that estimated like that 10% of innocent people were pleading guilty to crimes that they didn't commit. So that's what happened with Lorenzo. So it's kind of a bittersweet moment. I mean, because he's home. That's cool. And I'm happy that we played our role in the overall part of getting him home. But on the other hand, he's supposed to be home and exonerated. He's supposed to have his name. He's supposed to be eligible for compensation. He's supposed to, you know, be able to vote and not have a record when applying for a job or applying for an apartment.
And I know what he was going through because I had a lot of the similar same things going through my mind. You know, like if I cop out? Because, you know, they was coming at us with time and they want us to cop out. And, you know, after being here for 22 years straight, you know, I was horrified. I didn't want to go back either. So, you know, I understand why he made that decision.
Sure. Yeah. You know, so that was the sixth person my foundation has helped to regain their freedom, you know, two out of which were exonerations, William Lopez and William Haughey, and, you know, then the other four people. Well, we got out in different ways. Lorenzo, we just went over the story and other three people. And it was just clear that they were innocent from the pre-existing record. To go to court on an actual innocence, you have to find some previously unknown evidence of innocence. You know, it's like a puzzle, and it's not always possible to do that. I mean, it might be clear from the record that they're innocent, but you're not allowed to relitigate the record that's already there. You have to find something new, and that's not always possible. So, and that situation happens, we usually write letters to the parole board and we outline why we think somebody's innocent, and we ask the board not to deny them parole because they assert their innocence, as opposed to they want them to take responsibility, express remorse for something they didn't do. So we're 3-6 on that. You know, three times our letter was persuasive, and three people got out. Of course, the other three times they didn't listen to us.
I have another name associated with your foundation, and it's associated with an amicus brief. So I was wondering if you could tell us what an amicus brief is, and then maybe tell us about, I'm afraid I'm going to say his name wrong, it's Angelo.
Yeah, an amicus brief is a friend of the court brief. So what that means is that somebody who's not a party of the case, it's not the government and it's not the defendant, but they believe that their rights could be affected by the court's decision. They're allowed to submit a brief to the court and debate with what their position is. So in Angela DiPietro case, in that case too, that's not. And just to clarify, it's not a brief that's submitted like on behalf of one of the parties. I mean, because that's what your attorney does. But instead, you're addressing the one of the issues in the one or more of the issues in the case itself.
Like an injustice.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So first of all, the attorney that submitted that on behalf of the foundation, it was an exoneree himself. That's Keon Katibi from New York, who was exonerated after 9.5 years that he did for an assault with a deadly weapon that he didn't commit. So Keon recently became an attorney here in New York. So he's handling one case pro bono for us, and that's not counting this the DiPietro case, in which he filed an amicus brief on behalf of the foundation. So the issue in the DiPietro case that we felt was really important pertained to a Brady claim. So in a nutshell, so Brady pertains to information that the government is supposed to turn over to the defendant that is either pertaining to innocence or in some way could be helpful to the defense. So in a nutshell, the government was supposed to turn over some information to the defense in that case, but they didn't, and this was later discovered. And now that it's been discovered and it's being argued, the prosecution is arguing that they didn't have to turn it over because the information pertained to a witness that the defendant knew, right? So they're arguing that we didn't have to turn this over because the defendant knew this witness, right? But the defendant didn't know what the witness actually said to the police. But they're arguing that because he knew who that witness was, that witness was known to him, that was enough, that they didn't have to tell him about something that he knew. Mm. You know, so that's a really dangerous issue of law that could really hinder future litigants who are actually innocent and are trying to overturn their wrongful conviction. Because, I mean, you know, withholding evidence of innocence is unfortunately something that's very common. So we felt that issue, you know, affects, you know, future innocent people, and hence our desire to submit an amicus brief on that issue. So that was, we're waiting to hear back from the courts, you know, whether they're going to docket it and consider our amicus brief as opposed to just dismissing it. But we felt like the issue was important enough that we would file.
I just want to make sure I understand. So he knew this person, so they assumed that he had to know what this person told the police?
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
You're right. I agree with that.
I agree, too.
I agree.
We'll be back after a message from our sponsor.
It's officially fall, and with the temperatures dropping, I'm all about cozy layers, especially in the bedroom.
Crane & Canopy is an online bedding brand that's on a mission to give people the most blissful night's sleep with their luxurious collection of beautiful bedding, duvet covers, and sheets.
Crane & Canopy bedding is thoughtfully designed. Each of their duvet covers has built-in corner ties to ensure your comfort stays in place and zippers to make closing the duvet covers easy. Crane & Canopy in-house design team combine chic modern style with the finest details. Their bedding includes the season's freshest, and I mean freshest, colors and patterns, so you're sure to find bedding you love. Crane & Canopy make shopping for bedding easier than ever. They offer free returns as well as on-call customer service team to answer all your design questions.
To help you achieve your best night's sleep, Crane & Canopy is offering Actual Innocence listeners 10% off their next bedding purchase. To get this special offer, go to craneandcanopy.com/actual and use code ACTUAL at checkout to receive 10% off. That's C-R-A-N-E and canopy.com/actual and use the code ACTUAL for 10% off.
Man, Jeff, it seems like your foundation's been really busy. Are there any other cases that's getting your attention at the moment?
Yeah, there are. Yeah, definitely. I want to give a mention about the Andrew Privac case. So Andrew Privac's co-defendant, Anthony DiPippo, within the last year, was exonerated. So it was alleged that Anthony and Andrew Privac raped and murdered a girl in Putnam County. The whole theory is crazy. I'll try to be really brief and to the point, but it's claimed that Anthony and Andy, they raped a girl in a van, while three other people were present. Right now, right away, that makes no sense because murder and rape, that's a crime that's normally committed by one person, not two, and certainly not in front of additional parties, one of which was a girl who, after this supposed crime took place, went on to date Anthony for like a year and a half afterwards. So just think on a common sense level for a second. Who watches somebody commit a rape and murder, and then you're going to date them for like a year and a half before you finally say something? Before you finally say something to the police and point the finger. I mean, wouldn't you be afraid they're going to do the same thing to you?
Yeah, definitely.
Anthony was exonerated through the following way. I mean, he was originally wrongfully convicted. His conviction was overturned after 16 years because it was learned that his trial attorney had previously represented an alternative suspect who was a serial rapist whose M.O. was he would tie his victim's hands behind their back and stuff panties in their mouth. And that's the same way in which the victim in Andy and Anthony's case was found. So Anthony's trial lawyer, had previously represented the alternative suspect, the serial rapist named Howard Gombert. So that allowed him to get a reversal. But he went back to trial, only after trial, they didn't allow Anthony to present any evidence as to the alternative suspect. I mean, the victim was last seen alive with this alternative suspect. She was seen in a red car. Gombert had a red car. The license plate was a Connecticut plate. Gombert had a Connecticut plate. Gombert's MO was he used to get close to the victim's mother to then get to his victims, and he had gotten close to the victim in Anthony Andy's case. Then I mentioned to you about the hand behind the back and the panties in the mouth routine. And then in addition to that, while serving a 30-year sentence in Connecticut for sex crimes, Gombert confessed to another inmate. So Anthony was not allowed, the judge wouldn't allow Anthony to present any of that evidence at a second trial, and so he was wrongfully convicted a second time. So finally, after about 4 years, he got that conviction reversed, and the judge that with the Court of Appeals ruling that he was entitled to present that evidence. And so he, not wanting to admit the error, the Putnam County District Attorney, Bob Tendy, they retried the case. They retried the case, and he was allowed to present that evidence. And this time, Anthony was acquitted. I had made contact with Victor Sipos, who was an attorney in Utah, but who had graduated law school from Columbia. So he had been the attorney who had exonerated the Connecticut Four, and he had reached out to me because he wanted me to write a letter on behalf of his clients in furtherance of their receiving compensation in Connecticut, because there it's a board that decides it, not a court. So I gave him that, and then I established with him that if I had any other cases, he still told me that, well, if you have any other cases, you know, let me know. Because what my foundation does is, you know, we had full-time staff before ourselves. We used to have on-staff attorneys who were paid. But I had to convert the entity to a volunteer organization because it was really hard to raise money. And, you know, I reached the point where I couldn't write a large check every month. So what we were doing is, you know, we were screening and vetting the cases. And the ones that we found the innocence claim to be credible, and we found a way to win the case, you know, where there are leads to go in investigative-wise, we then pitch the cases to lawyers for them to carry out the investigation and then file the paperwork. So we brought Victor in to represent Andy, and then he then reached out to Adele Bernard, who's a really high-powered lawyer in New York. It's actually Peter Neufeld's wife, and she had pre-existing knowledge of Andy Prevac. She had a case; she had worked on it before that. So they were Andy's legal team. And so when Anthony got the reversal, they then filed a post-conviction motion for Andy Prevac, arguing that just like Anthony was given a new trial, where he had the right to present the evidence on the serial rapist's guilt, that Andy should be given the same right. So we felt really confident that, you know, he was entitled to a new trial. And in addition to that, the same polygraphist who polygraphed me and coerced a false confession out of me, he did the thing to Andy Prevac.
Terrible.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that
so
is.
So on those two grounds right there, we felt sure that he was going to get a new trial. But and then when Anthony was acquitted, we felt even stronger, because the legal standard is, whether or not this new evidence would likely have resulted in a different verdict. And here we got proof. This is a rare situation where we know there would have been a different verdict because the jury just acquitted acquitted his co-defendant. And it's the exact same set of facts, the exact same set of witnesses. The only difference is in the Andy Krivak case. Andy was coerced into a false confession by the same polygraphist who did that to me. Mm-hmm. But the judge turned the post-conviction motion down. In a nutshell, he ruled that none of the evidence against the serial rapist would have made a difference. It would not have overcome the confession that Krivak made, that a confession is extremely reliable evidence. He went back to a 1981 treatise that to support that position. Could you imagine that?
No, I can't.
Yes, so that is. So that's another case I want to highlight. That's in the works. So Andy was just granted permission to appeal to the appellate division, because when you lose a post-conviction motion, it's not an appeal as a matter of right. You have to get the court's permission. So he was just given permission to appeal, and we believe that, you know, he'll be home within the next year, you know, within a year. So that's one case. And so I want to highlight the Hector Lopez case. This is a wrongful conviction case out of the Bronx, which has two, I think, really clear red flags that it's a wrongful conviction case. So number one, it's a Detective Scarcella case. So anyone's listening that's not aware, Scarcella is that disgraced former detective out of Brooklyn who used the same drug addict as the sole eyewitness in six different homicide cases in Brooklyn, and whose confession cases have come under scrutiny too, because seemingly everybody who confesses to him starts out by saying, "Okay, you got me," or something similar to that. So depending on what newspaper article you read, between 40, 50, and 70 of his cases are being reviewed. And I want to say like six or seven of them have already been overturned.
Who says, "Okay, you got me"?
Okay, you got me.
Yeah, exactly. Who starts out?
Okay, you got me.
Yeah. I know. It's absurd on its face. So just the fact that this case involves Scarcella and it involves a confession which our client denies ever having made. Yeah, so that's Scarcella's MO, though. So at times, he's coerced people into false confessions, while at other times, he's employed even more extreme methods. So in the Shabaka Shakur case, where Shabaka was exonerated after 27 years, I mean, he made no confession at all. But that was the judge ruled, look, there's a good possibility there was no confession made at all. So he's not content to coerce. At times, he just outright fabricates. That's really scary if you think about it, though. That's really scary. So our client denies, you know, confessing. So, you know, being as though this involves Scarcella, that commonality, you know, that's like a big red flag. And then the second the second aspect of that is that it's an arson case. So we know that arson has really bubbled to the surface. That's not a science at all. That's a junk science. In essence, it's different. It's like folklore. It's just like tales that experienced arson investigators passed down from one generation to the next. You know, there's nothing scientific about it. And so this was an arson case, and we have an arson expert who's reviewed Hector's case and issued a report, and it's saying that the facts of the confession as Scarcella claims, like as to how the fire started, that's not how the fire could have started, I don't want to say evidentiary, because it is a junk science, but like where he's saying that, you know, the fire started, there was no accelerant or anything found on the floor there, it couldn't have happened the way that this confession is claiming. So that makes the confession in and of itself in super super suspect.
So using their own junk science against them, it's still not possible? I mean, is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah. That's what you're understanding. Yeah. We think that that's another case that's winnable. We believe in Hector's innocence, and we think that we're going to win the case. So in that one, Dennis, I just want to give a shout out to, attorney Dennis Kelly of New York, who has his law office in Glen Cove. So he's representing Hector pro bono. So that's another case where, you know, the foundation screened the case, and then we were able to successfully persuade, an attorney to, you know, take the case and do the legal investigative work. Yeah. I mean, look, in an ideal world, I mean, I would love to be able to, you know, raise lots of money and then once again, you know, have complete in-house staff and have the volunteers and the outside lawyers as supplemental. But yes, not my position at the moment. So being able to screen the cases and then connect people to the necessary legal services, I mean, that's a hell of a lot better than doing nothing at all. That beats a blank, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That definitely beats a blank. Okay, Jeff, you know, I've read a lot about you, but I don't think I know how your foundation was started.
It was started by, I was compensated and, I committed $1.5 million of that to launch the organization, and I wound up putting more money into it than that, before I had to convert it to volunteer organization. So we've been around for 5 years, and just want to mention, you know, some of the differences between my organization and other entities in the field, both when I started and now, is that you know, most of the organizations in the field, they only do DNA cases. And as you know, DNA is only available in 5 to 12% of all serious zombie cases. So we handle both DNA and non-DNA cases. And, you know, and by coincidence, the two cases we've helped people get exonerated, those were not DNA, cases. You know, we're the only entity started by an exoneree that has the exonerative component to it. And then, you know, we push legislation that a lot of the other entities privately agree with us on, but don't publicly push for. So for example, you know, we advocate for a commission on prosecutor conduct, you know, as part of there's a bigger coalition group called It Can Happen to You, which my foundation is a part of that coalition, and I'm an advisory board member. We're trying to get the state to pass a commission bill, which would be like an independent oversight to prosecutors. So we were the lead entity on that for, you know, a lot of years. We've been at that for like 5 years before we wound up. The Innocence Project gave us a memo of support within the last year. So that was one thing. And I've raised issues like, I mean, the whole problem of, you know, innocent people, to catch the innocent prisoners dilemma, where, you know, innocent people are being forced to either falsely admit guilt at the parole board, or else risk having their already unjust prison stay lengthened. Either that, or you falsely admit guilt, but then if you do get a reversal, but the case isn't dismissed, the prosecution can try to use the statements that you make at the hearing to try to re-wrongfully convict. So that's another example of a different issue that the other organizations in the field, they reference it, but it's mainly in the context of discussing the narrative of somebody's story. Like, they haven't raised it with like elected officials, and that's definitely something that I've done.
We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
I know the summer is supposed to be almost over, and I'm ready for all things pumpkin spice. But with temperatures here in the 90s and my Kopari products, I feel like summer's been extended. Kopari makes multitasking skincare products that are free from sulfates, silicones, and GMOs or parabens.
I like that it leaves my skin feeling soft, but it's not greasy, even though it's made of 100% coconut oil.
I'm so glad you decided to try it. Which product is your favorite?
I like the coconut body milk. My skin feels hydrated and refreshed. I use it a lot after I've been in and out of the sun all day.
That's a good one. I like to use the lip moisturizer. What do you think of the smell?
The smell? Whew, I love the smell. It reminds me of the beach, but it's not overwhelming, which is also great.
Well, our listeners can say aloha to the best skin and hair of their lives with Kopari. Go to KopariBeauty.com/actual to get 20% off your order. That's K-O-P-A-R-I, KopariBeauty.com/actual for 20% off. KopariBeauty.com/actual. Your foundation is involved in the political scene. And so can you tell me more about the bill that you're supporting about prosecutor misconduct?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so it would create a commission on prosecutor conduct. So it would be like an independent oversight board, and it's modeled after the Commission on Judicial Conduct. So there's actually, right now, there is no entity that oversees the prosecutors. So when they engage in misconduct, you know, nothing happens to them. They're not subject to any criminal penalties. I think California just passed something on that, but they're like the only state. You can't sue them. You can't sue them because they have immunity, and there's no other means of holding them accountable. So this would change that. So the commission would be independent. It would have subpoena power, and it could investigate allegations of prosecutorial misconduct. And, you know, it could either substantiate them or it could clear somebody. And if it found that there was misconduct, it could recommend a menu of select what they think the appropriate penalty would be, up to and including recommendation of removal from office.
I love it. That's a great idea.
So, oh yeah, that's a wonderful idea. I love it.
So we think that would, that would be like a deterrent, because right now there's nothing to deter, and that's why prosecutorial misconduct is so rampant throughout the system. It's out of control. But, but the prosecutors in general, they deny that there's a problem. They say it's not, it happens very rarely. And to the extent that it does happen, we discipline our own. And, the present system is just fine. Thank you. in my case, the prosecutor withheld, he withheld evidence that, the medical, that the, he withheld evidence that the medical examiner, in my case, had been complained of in neighboring jurisdictions by law enforcement, and he was just giving unreliable testimony, yet he never turned that over. He used the evidence anyway, and we found three other cases where that prosecutor and the medical examiner, every time they get together and tag team, the CEO, this medical examiner, is always altering his findings to fit the prosecution theory. But yet when I did name him in my civil rights lawsuit, that was the only part of the case that I lost. And the judge's ruling when he dismissed the case based on prosecutorial immunity, he wrote that he wasn't dismissing because he didn't find that the allegations weren't serious or that I couldn't prove it, but that he just felt constrained by the law that he had to do it. And in his footnote, he said that I should raise the issue, file a complaint at the bar. But when I finished my lawsuit and I won everything and I went back to the same lawyers that I just successfully represented me, and I said, look, I don't want to let this prosecutor go. Let's file this complaint. I want to hold him accountable, too, to the extent we can. Let's file this complaint. My lawyer said, look, that's a waste of time, Jeff. Nothing ever happens. They're not going to do anything. So he got away with what he did to me. And, that's what happens in all these cases. They get away with their misconduct, and I don't feel like it's right. And I think the first step in doing anything is just, let's just have this commission passed, and then we can see how that works and determine whether we need additional measures. Things like removing immunity or like what California did, let's start criminalizing it. I like those other ideas, but I want to do one thing at a time, and it's been really hard. We've come really, really close, so close to getting it passed the last 3 years. And then what happens at the end of the session, the prosecutors start calling their elected officials, and now all of a sudden everybody who's sponsored the bill or saying they're going to vote on it, everybody gets cold feet, and the end result is we get all the way to the end. All they have to do is just bring the bill up to the floor for a general vote, and suddenly we can't get the bill to the floor to get a vote.
That's tragic.
No, but we're not quitting. We're not going away, and we're going to keep fighting. We keep, building our coalition, and we're going to continue doing research. So we started this last year, and we're going to continue. We've been looking at the financial impact of prosecutorial misconduct. So just tabulating, how much does the proceeding with this prosecutorial misconduct, how much did the criminal trial and then the appeals afterwards cost? And then, the litigation that happens after when someone's been exonerated, both the payouts and compensation, both through federal lawsuits and state compensation, the attorney fees that are both the New York State and the municipalities pay, and just calculating from a financial point of view, look, this is how much money all this misconduct is costing. And so we're just trying to use the fiscal argument, because whatever argument, different arguments appeal to different people. And as long as we're advancing truthful arguments, we don't mind what the line of reasoning is that people take to come to their conclusion. As long as we can get the bill passed, put this additional protection in place to prevent wrongful convictions, because that's the impact on the person and their family, and then the societal danger of leaving the actual perpetrator free. There's tremendous costs. There's only one winner in that situation, and that's the actual criminal who continues to remain undetected. That's the only winner in that.
So, Jeff, can I ask you a question about yourself?
Yeah, whatever you guys would like.
I heard you recently went back to high school.
Yes,
I did, but I did, but it was a high school reunion, not as a student to finally get my GED that I never got. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, it was well pointed out for the record. You know, when I was in prison, I did get the GED and I got the associates and continued on towards a bachelor's. And then when I was before the funding was cut by then Governor Pataki. And I just want to make a brief statement real quick to interrupt my own self here. You know, the college education program in prison, I feel so strongly about that because, you know, prisoners who receive a college education, the recidivism rate is so low, whereas normally the average is like between 50 and 60% of prisoners who do go back to prison who don't receive college education as opposed to who they do. And looking at myself, you know, I had that much less to do when I came home in terms of my formal education comparing to, you know, if I didn't. I mean, I only had to do like a year when I came home. I received a scholarship from Mercy College, which I used to finish to get the bachelor's degree in behavioral science. And then I went from there. I got a master's from John Jay, which included a thesis on wrongful conviction cause and reforms. And then I'm in school now, but I guess that'll be another question. But in terms of going back to high school, I went back to my first high school reunion, and it was kind of an emotional experience for me because I didn't graduate with my classmates. You know, I was arrested and ultimately wrongfully convicted of murdering while I was in high school, and the crime was murdering and raping a classmate. You know, so the last time I was collectively, you know, in front of the people in the high school, I mean, they know me as somebody who was wrongfully arrested and convicted of fraud. I was a classmate. I was a publicly hated figure that hadn't been a murderer in Peekskill for like 20 years, and everybody was talking about, you know, it was talking about the crime. I mean, parents were coming to the high school to pick their kids up after school and bring them right home. I mean, the city was in fear. And then when I was arrested and I went to trial, every time I went to court, it was a major media moment, and virtually all the coverage was from a guilt presumptive oriented perspective. So I was a really hated figure. But people reached out to me through social media to attend the reunion. And so, you know, I went back and forth a little bit as to whether I should go. But ultimately, I was persuaded to go. People encouraged me to go. And
I bet that took a lot of guts. And that's big.
Yeah, it did. I was nervous thinking about it. I was nervous driving my car from my house to where the reunion was, you know, being held at. I was about 50 minutes away. And even once I parked the car, I'm walking in the parking lot there and I see people, and I paused and I like gave one last thought. Well, maybe this isn't a good idea. I was just about to turn around and go back to my car and just leave. And this woman yelled out, "There's Jeff. Jeff, come in this way. Come in." Yeah. But I heard, I said, "There's Jeff." Like, I thought like the next statement was going to be like a hate-filled, let's go get him type of thing. But instead it was a welcoming, come in this way, Jeff, come in this way. Yeah.
They were excited to see you.
Yeah. So, yeah, they were. It was kind of emotional for me and everybody else that was there. So, you know, we had a lot of in-depth, meaningful conversations, and even people that didn't know me in high school but were aware of my story. I mean, everybody, you know, greeted me. They took pictures with me. They, you know, they welcomed me home, and you know, they made me feel welcome. And they all had empathy for me, and they all not only knew my story, but they also congratulated me on the work that I'm doing now, and they wanted me to. They all urged me to continue what I was doing. And I want to say, like, the emotional highlight of the evening was I saw the yearbook that somebody brought the yearbook from the year that I was arrested, and I saw it on the table. So I went over and I looked, and you know, I saw that they didn't. My photo was not. My photo had not been removed from the yearbook. I mean, I took that photo shortly before I was arrested, and you know, considering that I had been, you know, arrested for murdering and raping a classmate, I thought that the school officials had removed my photo from it, but they didn't.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, let's just say the water turned on a little bit. The water turned on a little bit. So, but I felt good that they, yeah, but it meant so much that they didn't take it out. I would have understood the other way, but you know, but just it validated my belonging there, and you know that somebody saw me and they called me over to them and they said, "Listen, don't think about that. You know, just don't go back there emotionally. Just, you know, you're here now. We're in the present, and you know you're accepted, and everybody knows that you're innocent, and we're all so happy that you're here, and you know you love that you're doing great work now, and you know just focus in on that." Just focus in on that, and that's what I needed to hear. That's what I needed to hear.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I can relate. You know, I was in high school 22, 23 years ago. I missed my prom, and I always imagined going back. But you know, I got my GED inside now, thanks to some encouraging words that you gave me several months ago. You know, I'll be going back to college in spring.
Oh, that's great. I'm really, really happy to hear that.
Yeah, wow, so, you know, I just want to say thank you, you know, because I see the work that you're doing, and, you know, and I admire you, you know, how you're getting out and after going through what we went through, for you to make that transition and doing all the positive things that you're doing, you know, I commend you. You know?
The recognition matters. It means a lot to me, especially from a fellow exoneree, you know, in a way, you know, we have like a fellowship, a camaraderie, a bond. We do that experience that we went through, was that we speak a different language in a way. So, you know, it is good to be recognized in general. I mean, I feel like that's healing, but it's especially meaningful when, you know, another exoneree, you know, recognizes. So
Yeah,
you touched me just then.
Yeah.
So if you get a chance to go to your high school reunion, I would suggest that I would recommend that you go, because I feel like I achieved a kind of closure by going. I feel like I found a part of my life that night, you know, and I feel like I regained my community of classmates, and you know, I needed that. I needed that, and I feel more complete now that I did that. And you know, I don't know how it's going to turn out, but you know, I've asked the school going through intermediaries, but I asked the school to do something for me that, you know, Bronx High School did for the Central Park Five. You know, I asked them, I told them that I want to graduate. I want a high school diploma from them, you know, when they have their next graduation, you know, I want to walk across that stage with everybody and I want to get my high school diploma. So I asked them to do that. I'm waiting to see what they do, but that's another step that, I asked, maybe that might be something you try to pursue too.
Yeah, that'd be huge.
Yeah, that would be huge. So I'm hoping that they do that for me, and I feel like that could be another step for me, because if my life wasn't interrupted by the wrongful conviction, then you know, I was going to graduate. You know, I wasn't en route to drop out. You know, even before, I wanted to be a lawyer. You know, I wasn't thinking about wrongful convictions, but you know, I you know, so I'm still doing what
I was going to do just many years later.
I think you're a great example.
Yes, he is. He's definitely a great example.
I mean, you have not let this stand in your way at all. Like, you know, jokingly, you went back to high school, but you did. You went back to this place where you had this terrible experience, and it's inspirational. Like, I think that it's amazing. And not just high school. You didn't stop there because you're going on to a different kind of school too, right? You've went on there?
Yeah, I kind of sort of let the cat out the bag a minute ago, but I'm in law school and I'm in my second year. I'm at Pace. I'm at the Elizabeth Hobbs School of Law at Pace University. It's in White Plains, which is where the county court is in Westchester. So it's only 9.5 blocks away from the court where I was wrongfully convicted in and ultimately exonerated and walked out of. There's a sentimental value in going there. So I'm going because I want to continue to be involved in exonerating people, but I'm not content to be sitting in the front row in the audience in the cases. I mean, even though my foundation, we might be the ones who screened the case and got the lawyers involved and, you know, are planning with them, you know, outlining the strategy and being involved in the prep and all that. But at the end, I can only sit there in the front row. I can't sit at the defense table. I'm not allowed to directly speak to the judge. So I'm in law school because that's not good enough for me anymore. You know, I want to be the lawyer some of those cases. So maybe to put it in football terms, you know, I'm not content to be the head coach anymore. I want to be on the field. I want to be on the field and play quarterback.
I'm happy for you, Jeff. I'm happy for you.
I really appreciate that. And, you know, at this time, you know, I want to recognize some people that, you know, serve as kind of an inspiration, you know, to me in going through this really difficult journey of even being in law school. You know, I want to recognize exonerees, Jared Adams, you know, who already is an attorney, who already helped free somebody.
Yeah.
Keon Katibi, who's, you know, he was a lawyer who's filed the amicus and, you know, is working on another case pro bono for my foundation. Marty Tancliffe, Donald Glassman. I've never met Anthony Robinson, but I've read articles, you know, where he was admitted to not just a lawyer, but he was admitted to even argue cases at the U.S. Supreme Court. So all these other and, of course, the forerunner of us all, the very first exoneree was exoneree Chris Ochoa. From Texas. He was the first exoneree to become a lawyer. So all of those exonerees serve as like an inspiration to me because law school is very hard. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that, you know, I've been pulling my hair out or I feel stressed out or, you know, I feel for sure I'm going to fail. This is too much work. I can't do it. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've had to get by on 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hours sleep, you know, but I keep going. People keep encouraging me and I keep going. But I also think in those moments too, you know, those other guys, they had a hard time and they didn't stop. They kept going. They're lawyers. And, you know, if they can make it, I can make it. And sometimes I even call them on the phone. Sometimes I even speak to Keon on the phone. I speak to Marty. I call Jarrett and yo, this is my problem now, man. I feel like this or like that, or my head's going to explode or I can't keep this. Listen, man, you really think this is the right thing for me and, you know, other stuff like that. Or look, you know, one time Marty called me not too long ago. Look, these are the tactics and techniques that I've used, that, you know, that I found helpful. So tips. So all those kind of things, you know, just want to recognize all those, you know, the other people, you know, before me.
Jeff, I have only talked to you a few times. I know we met at the Innocence Conference last year, but I think you can do anything. Like listening to your story and your determination, I think that there is nothing that you can't do that you put your mind to.
I concur.
I'm definitely going to keep that in mind and use that as an encouragement because, you know, I have lofty plans and, you know, it doesn't end at trying to be a lawyer and exonerate people. But I mean, I want to continue to do that type of work. But but just continuing, you know, upwards. You know, maybe I'll just say it here, man. This will be the first media outlet I ever say this to. So here's a first, okay? You can say you got the with exclusive. Yeah, you got the exclusive, okay? I'll give you the exclusive. So yes, I want to exonerate people. That's why I'm there in law school. That's why I'm getting law degree. I want to be the lawyer. But it's not simply to do that from the outside as a lawyer. Yes, I want to do that. But, you know, when it's the right time, in the right race, and in the right opponent, you know, I want to run for district attorney and have a real conviction review. Like Brooklyn DA Ken Thompson did, you know, he exonerated 23 people in 2.5 years, which is a result you could never do on the outside from nonprofit field. And, you know, former Dallas DA Craig Watkins, more than 40 people exonerated. So that's part of my plans. That's part of my plans. But that's your exclusive. So I dare not say what my plans beyond that are, but I'll leave it at there. But it all involves trying to free people. So that's, you know, then from there, maybe some further further upward mobility, but retaining the ability to make an impact as far as freeing people and trying to help on a policy level. And, you know, the awareness that can flow from that. I mean, it's all could be incredible impact. It could be an incredible impact. And, you know, the more I can do with that, the more healing I can do and the more satisfying I can feel. And I want to make a difference. And you know, I'm my own worst critic. I mean, I feel like I haven't really done too much. I feel like I haven't done too much compared to what I would like to do. So
your motivation.
My buddy DeMarco is, he's been my co-host and he's amazing. Like I feel so fortunate to have found him, but I'm wondering, do DeMarco and I have some radio competition? I've heard that you yourself have been doing some radio.
Yeah. So there's another advocate, Frank Vitro, and he has, he was a former, high school principal when he, you know, I found himself, falsely accused of, 8 misdemeanors. And so, not only did he lose his job, but he lost his house. And at one point, he was living out of his car. And in the end, he had to plead guilty to 8 misdemeanors. And, you know, he's, you know, at a private school. And, you know, he's back on his feet now. And he's an advocate. He wrote a book appropriately called Standing on Principle, because he was a school principal at the time everything happened to him. So it's a play on words. So he has 2 radio shows, one of which is called Standing on Principle. And the second show is called The Frank Vitro Show. And so Frank, out of Long Island, has where we collaborates with the foundation and I. He donates an episode from the Frank Vitro Show. We do it bi-monthly, every month and a half to 2 months. Yeah, he donates the Frank Vitro Show. Well, the Frank Vitro Show and the foundation, we bring the public a special sub-series. Is called The Guilty Plea Problem. You know, which is a show which is designed to designed to be like a support to the Innocence Project's initiative, Guilty Plea Problem. So we interview and I co-host shows where we're interviewing exonerees who've been wrongfully convicted via guilty plea. So yeah, so I mean, we have like the promo and we advertise it on the internet and people can listen to it. Both on the physical radio as well as through the internet. And Frank has a really catchy slogan for the Frank Vitro Show in general, which we use both for his regular Frank Vitro Show as well as the special Guilty Plea Problem shows. He says, you know, he always says, you know, hop on the V train. I love working with Frank because he's got so much energy and he's so passionate. And I mean, by the way, he's uncovered new evidence that he didn't have, and he's back in court. He's still trying to, you know, overturn his wrongful conviction. And he's really passionate guy. And you should hear him when he says his slogan. He always says, hop on the V train. The next stop is justice. And I'm taking you there.
I love it.
I'll put a link to his show in the show notes for this episode.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you. We really appreciate that. And for sure, we would like to help promote the work that you and DeMarco are doing there. Because look, this is such a huge problem. You know, wrongful convictions is so huge, and we need as many eyeballs, we need as many ears on this problem as we can possibly have. So the more people that are doing this kind of work, the more is needed. And you know, we feel in solidarity with anybody who's doing any kind of work trying to raise awareness on wrongful conviction on any level.
I agree. Jason Flom's show, Wrongful Conviction, is amazing. And people have asked me before, you know, aren't you like, isn't he the competition? And I said, no, it's not a competition. It's a battle. And we're all on the same team.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. Sure. I've been on Jason Flom's show before with Jared Adams and Amanda Knox. There was a special special holiday episode. It was a couple of weeks before. There's kind of like gallows humor. I mean, we've been through hell and back. I mean, some of the absurdity of things are almost laughable because, you know, you're going to implode if you don't. So that holiday episode was called, which Jason made up. I think it appeared to me like he made up the subtitle of that particular episode. We were talking about holidays, you know, Christmas and also Thanksgiving, but holidays in Christmas, you know, like then and now, you know, you're thinking about, you know, talking about what it's like to be in prison wrongfully on the holidays and then contrasting that to now. This subtitle to it, he called it a very special wrongful Christmas.
That was good.
Yeah, and so actually a couple of clients called in from prison. I was just feeling kind of giddy, and they called me from prison. So imagine you're me for a second, and you accept the collect call from prison right after that, and then they ask, the people always ask me, hey, what have you been up to? Because they're trying to live vicariously a little bit through you for the moment, you know. And so I told them about the episode, and then I mentioned the subtitle. And then I can hear them like a pause and the gears turning on their end, like they're trying to think what that means. And then I quickly added, you know, like the one you're about to experience. And then they started laughing. And then they started laughing and they said, yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've been on Jason's show. That's a great show. And in fact, I'm going to make another appearance on there. We're going to talk about my story. And, you know, Jason's brought attention. He just interviewed Lorenzo Johnson yesterday, and he also did a prison interview with Angie on with Andy Krivak with Adele Benoit. They went up to the prison itself in Wendy and interviewed Andy there, and so I'm gonna do it too. So Jason's been great.
He's a good guy.
He's a really good guy. Yeah,
you got a lot going.
I do. And sometimes that causes me to have to do extreme things. You know, I mean, so what I mean by that is, I mean, I usually have to give up one week and day a week. You know, I might have to wake up around 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning on one of the weekend days and, you know, just don't stop doing my law school work until, you know, around 11 or 12 at night. Mm. So I'm doing that. And then there's been plenty of times I've, you know, worked until maybe 1 or 2 in the morning. No, because I don't, you know, I don't stop, you know, when I get the opportunities, you know, I take them. When I get a chance to do a speaking engagement, I take them. And the only thing I do in my mind is, all right, well, if I'm going to go and speak here, if I'm going to do this radio interview there, I was going to study from here to there, but now I can't because I'm doing this. So where am I going to make that time up? What other time slot can I make up? Can I make up to then keep pace with the class and other people in the law school? So, you know, sometimes I have to do extreme things like that, but you know, what's the alternative?
We appreciate you.
Both of you, you know the value of time better than I ever will. And I just appreciate your time every time that I get to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate you guys too, because, you know, I can't reach people, you know, the medium of doing the interview, I mean, I reached many more people than I ever could through any other way. And I think, you know, as an advocate, I mean, if I was to just like drop off the earth for a couple of years until I finish and then suddenly show back up, I don't feel like I'd have the same momentum. I don't know that I would be able to, you know, restart and be at the same level I'm at. So, you know, I'm not willing to take that chance. You know, I don't want to be less effective. So hence I do what I do.
So if the people listening to the show wanted to support or even just find out more information about your foundation, how did they do that?
Sure. They could go to my website. The website is deskvic.org, deskovic.org. In terms of support foundation, we have a campaign on a crowdfunding platform. The website is Patreon. So if people go to Google and they type in Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and then put my last name, Deskovic, a link would come up that they could click on it and they could see where the foundation's raising money. So my dream is this. Dream with me for a second. All right, close your eyes, everybody. Imagine if there were 25,000 people who could afford to give $3 a month on a recurring basis, right? They were willing to sacrifice $3 every month in order to help free innocent people. That would give us a budget close to $1 million. And I have everything scoped out on the Patreon site, exactly what the money would, you know, these are how many lawyers we could get. This is how many paralegals we could get. This is how many investigators and the other components necessary to really have, you know, a robust team. And it's all priced out according to nonprofit standards and, you know, with some money built in to be able to have like a gala dinner and fundraising activities. So that's my dream. You know, if we can do what we've done, you know, on a shoestring budget, I mean, imagine if we, you know, were able to have further infrastructure in place. You know, imagine what we could do then. And, you know, there's we have like a backlog. There's like 400 or 500 cases that are just raw cases. Just people have been waiting as long as 3 or 4 years just to have their cases screened, just for us to tell them yay or nay. You know, but when you're averaging like 10 to 15 requests for help and there's very little outside financial support, that's what happens. I need the public's help to be able to free more people, you know, than what we're able to do right now. So hopefully that can happen. And, you know, we need the people to donate the money recurring. But more than that, I mean, that's necessary. That's essential. But we need people who can help make the campaign go viral. We need people to help. I mean, we need to get out of my networking, get into the networks of other people and their networks and their networks and their networks and their networks. I mean, there's so many videos on social media on so often what I consider to be silly topics that capture the public's imagination and they go viral. And this is something so meaningful, like DeMarco was real, I'm real, William Lopez, real, William Haughey, real, Lorenzo Johnson, real, Andy Kravac is a person, so is Hector Lopez, and, you know, we're not just words, we're not just concepts, we're actual people, you know, and I know that there's more people that we could save if we had more resources.
I'm just happy that Jeff's, you know, he's leading by example and doing a lot of positive things, you know, in his community, for his people, for people around the world. And he's doing a lot of stand up solid things. And I commend him and I'm happy for him. And I'm hoping to one day be following and leading and standing next to him, you know, any of those things. Because we could lead, we could follow, we can stand next to him and help the situation. So I commend Jeff on all his honorable work.
Jeff said something about running for attorney general someday, but I can see him in a much higher position. Like, he has leadership skills.
Oh, definitely. And I can see him in a much higher position.
Best of luck to Jeff. So until next time, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website, actualinpod.com, for pictures, transcripts,
more information about our guests, and a calendar of upcoming episodes. Our website guru is Sean Cole, and our VIP of transcripts is Christina Judge. Our well-read and well-connected social media superstar is Cameron Taylor, and our volunteer of all trades is Casey Weber. Original music, scoring, and podcast production is done by musical genius Blake Maples. You can see and hear more of his work at blakemaples.com. Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. You can hang out with us on Facebook in the group called the Official Actual Innocence and Convicted Discussion Group. Just ask to join and we'll let you in. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.